I have to go catch my bus, unfortunately.
Right. Bye. Have a good night. He stands a little straighter as he walks off. 32. On Saturday morning, I get a call from a junior at MIT. My name is Amala Duval, she tells me. I'm a math major. Great, I stammer after an awkward pause. How are you? I'm studying theoretical mathematics at MIT, she says, dead serious by the sound of it. How do you think I am? So good, right? For the right kind of people, she says, like she hasn't made up her mind yet that I am the right kind of person. It is amazing. Who's that? Mom asks me from across the breakfast table. MIT, I mouth, and her eyes widen. She takes her coffee cup and disappears into the living room. So, it looks like you have an RSVP'd to the campus visit next month, Amala continues. Oh, no, I am planning on coming to that, I tell her. I've just had a lot on my plate lately, so I haven't gotten around to... Are you considering another school? She asks me, point blank. No, I blurt. No, it's MIT for me. It's always been MIT. Because I will just tell you, and not because it's my job to tell you this at this point, but if you love math, you should come to MIT. It'd be stupid to go anywhere else. I completely agree, I say. That's why, and not just because the professors are phenomenal and you'll be challenged and you'll be working on things you've never dreamed about, but because you're allowed to be yourself here. You're not expected to mold yourself into something else. You're celebrated for your own particular intellect, and that's something I don't think you can find anywhere else, okay? Okay. So sign up for the campus visit. I'll show you around. Okay. And keep those grades up, all right? They were serious about that. Because, yes, they will accept you for who you are here, but they will also expect nothing less than your very best work. Got it? Yes, I say, finding myself nodding even though she can't see me. I understand. I'll see you in a few weeks then, she says. Yeah, I'll see you then. The minute I hang up the phone, Mom comes charging back into the kitchen. I wonder if she was just outside the door listening, although I'm sure she couldn't have gotten much from my series of okays. Everything all right? She asks. Excitement flutters in my stomach. I'm really going to MIT, I say, and it finally feels true. I have to write that stupid essay for English class, if Mrs. Blackburn will accept it more than a month late. I have to go to Miss Mahoney and see if I can improve upon my tragic midterm score. I have to show them my best. Mom smiles, too. You're really going to MIT. I'm still in a bit of a daze from the MIT call when I meet Damien in the cafe at South Point Barnes & Noble. He looks freshly showered, and he's wearing a black polo and clean jeans and not his standard gray hoodie. I order a green tea latte.
Are those good? He asks when I pick it up from the end of the counter. They're so green. They look like blended grass.
They grow on you, I answer. He orders a salted caramel mocha. We sit at a table for a while and discuss Kafka. Damien gives me a few other titles to try. Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, and James Joyce's Dubliners, and Herman Melville's Moby Dick. I'm going to be busy reading for a while. Then the conversation stalls. So, I say after a few minutes of awkward silence, this is going to sound silly, but I've become interested in poetry lately.
What's silly about poetry?
He asks, shifting in his chair.
Nothing, there's nothing silly about poetry, but I've been wanting to write some, and I'm finding out that I'm not any good at it. Do you read poetry?
Yeah, I read poetry, he says lightly. I write some, too.
Maybe you could give me some suggestions for poets I could read, and then I could imitate them or use them for inspiration, or you could tutor me.
Lex, he interrupts. Stop.
I stop my babbling.
What?
You don't have to.
He smiles.
You don't have to come up with ways to get my attention.
He reaches across the table and puts his hand over mine.
I get it, he says. I know what you're doing.
Heat rushes to my face. You do?
When did you figure it out? He asks. I stare at him, then at his hand.
Figure it out, I repeat.
He laughs. I knew it. On Wednesday, when you came up to me and wanted to talk about Heart of Darkness, I thought, she knows.
Naturally, I have no idea what he's talking about. There's something off about the way he's looking at me, a warmth in his gray eyes, an expectation. He's been interpreting this all wrong. I am stupid. I am smart, sure, but oh boy, in the romance department, I am a moron.
Damien, I don't know how to back out of this. He lets go of my hand to reach down to unzip his backpack.
I brought you something.
He pulls out a rose made of paper. It's made of red paper this time. There are words on this one, too, an entire poem I can only read part of. Loving in truth, and fain in verse my love to show that the dear she might take some pleasure of my pain. Pleasure might cause her read, reading might make her know.
It was you, I breathe.
Guilty, he says.
Last year, too. Valentine's Day, it was you.
I found a pattern for a paper daisy in one of my mom's old magazines, he says. And I thought of you. I'm glad you figured it out. I've wanted to tell you for such a long time.
Why didn't you just write your name on it? I ask, stricken.
Too chicken, I guess. It was more romantic that way, right? And then you had a boyfriend, and you seemed happy with him, so I didn't want to...
He puts his hand over mine again.
But then you broke up with your boyfriend, and you and I started to talk more, and I thought... Lex?
I've closed my eyes. Stephen didn't give me the flowers. He didn't write those words to me.
The disappointment of this revelation is like a knife in my chest, a hard pain, sharp and penetrating. This is our place, too, this bookstore where Stephen asked me, right over there, where I said yes, and part of the reason I said yes was the paper flower. It's not fair, I think, on top of everything else that gets taken away. I want Stephen to be the one who made me that flower.
Lex.
Damien tries to console me for all the wrong reasons.
Hey, it's okay that you didn't figure it out earlier. You figured it out now. We can make up for lost time, right?
I open my eyes just as he's leaning across the table to touch my cheek. I flinch and pull away, my hand sliding out from under his.
No.
His smile fades.
I'm sorry, I gasp. This isn't... I didn't mean to lead you on. I didn't know.
He sits back.
You didn't know I made the flowers.
I shake my head, horrified at my own stupidity.
But then why have you been talking to me? You've been acting interested. You were acting like you liked me.
This is a train wreck. Damien, I do like you, I begin, but I don't feel like... It's not a romantic kind of thing. That's not what this is about for me.
His gray eyes are like cool stone now, unreachable.
You were buttering me up, he says in a low voice. You were using me.
No.
Did you even read The Metamorphosis? Or was all this some kind of bribe, so you could prep for MIT?
Yes! I mean, no, it wasn't a bribe. I did read the book. I liked it, I swear.
What is this, then? What do you want?
He's talking so loud that people are starting to glance over.
Nothing, I say quietly. I thought you seemed lonely is all. I thought you could use a friend.
Wrong answer. Damien draws himself up.
Oh, how altruistic of you, Lex, since you're such a friendly girl yourself.
Hey, I object. Let's not forget that you had ulterior motives here, too. You were using the book thing to seduce me, right? You weren't just helping me out of the goodness of your heart.
He snorts.
Seduce is a strong word. And I was only doing it because I thought that's what you were doing. I thought you liked me,
he accuses, spitting out the tea on thought.
I really thought you liked me.
For a moment, his expression is tragic, like he might cry. Then he hardens himself.
I was wrong.
He's so upset that his hands shake as he gathers up his books. Damien, please, I'm so sorry.
Don't, he says sharply. I don't need your pity. You don't get to use me as your charity case because you feel bad that your brother died. I'm fine.
Then he's gone. The people around me stare for a minute and then go back to their previous conversations. I swallow. I have to live with the fact that, in spite of my good intentions, I have just made everything worse. 30th of March. The last time I saw my brother, in real life I mean, it was the morning of December 20th, the morning of the day he died. It started like any other morning. Mom cooked breakfast, we all sat around the table together, Mom with her cup of coffee and her toast, looking through a nursing scrubs catalog, and me daydreaming about MIT, which I had just sent in my application for, and Ty doing what he always did at breakfast time, eating enough food to sustain a small African village. I probably made some comment about it, the way he always ate like he was never going to get another meal. He probably made his usual comment that he was a growing boy. I don't remember that part. What I do remember is that sometime during that meal, Ty cleared his throat and said,
I was thinking about maybe getting my own car.
Mom stopped perusing uniforms, and I stopped imagining the tree-lined walkways at MIT, and we both looked at him. This comment was a little out of the blue, I thought. He hadn't even mentioned the idea of his own car around his 16th birthday.
Okay, Mom said thoughtfully. So how are you planning to acquire this car?
His face fell.
I was thinking that maybe between you and Dad, you might be able to...
He swallowed hard.
It wouldn't have to be a very nice car.
Mom was already shaking her head.
We don't have that kind of cash right now, honey. I'm sorry.
Because of the divorce, I thought, and didn't say. Ty turned to me for support. I lifted my hands in surrender. Hey, don't look at me. I worked after school for 3 years to buy the lemon, and it's the lemon.
Yes, that's what you'll have to do, honey, Mom said. You'll have to save up.
Ty nodded, but it was a resigned kind of nod. He knew there was no way for him to get a real job with all his extracurricular activities, basketball being the big one. I tried to soften the blow.
But come on, what would you do with a car, really?
His eyes flashed.
I'd drive to school. I'd have my license. I'd take girls out on dates. I'd take road trips. Get out of the state of Nebraska for once in my stupid life.
Mom and I exchanged worried glances. Ty closed his eyes and sighed.
Anyway, it's fine. I just thought I'd ask.
And he went back to shoveling in his food. I was thinking, as I finished up my own breakfast, that I could give him the lemon. Once I got to MIT, of course. I wouldn't need a car there. It was the lemon, but still, it was a car. Maybe Ty could do what I had never bothered to attempt. He could fix the lemon up. But I didn't say any of that. I didn't tell him. Mom finished her coffee.
It's off to work I go, she said cheerily.
She paused as she got up from the table to smooth down a tuft of Ty's hair that was sticking up in back.
Have a good day, my beautiful children.
I probably rolled my eyes. Ty and I finished eating, and I left him to wash the dishes, because it was his turn. I was nearly out the front door when I stopped to call out something like, Hey, you better get with it or you'll miss the bus. Ty appeared in the doorway.
I've got a ride with one of my buddies, he said.
A lie. I didn't know that it was a lie, so I said whatever it was that I said, and I left the house. That was the last time I saw him alive. The last time. But in the past few months, I found a way to reconstruct the rest of December 20th. I can put the pieces together. I can figure out what happened from there. First, Ty finished the dishes and ran the dishwasher, because it was his turn. Then he waited for the school to call the house to inquire about his absence. He told the secretary that he was homesick. The stomach flu, he said. Couldn't keep anything down, he said. And that Mom forgot to phone it in, but he'd get her to call from work later. Then he walked 7 miles in the ice and snow to the nearest city bus stop. He rode a bus into Lincoln and disembarked at the Westfield Gateway Mall. This, according to a wad of receipts I found in his back jeans pocket in his clothes hamper, was what his next few hours looked like. 11:17 a.m., Foot Locker, Nike LeBron 11 basketball shoes, $199.99. 11:33 a.m., Lids, Trailblazers t-shirt, $24. 11:49 a.m., Sunglass Hut, Ray-Ban polarized sunglasses, $149.95. 12:14 p.m., Panda Express, Shanghai Angus Steak Bowl, $7.95. 12:36 p.m., Master Cuts, Shampoo and Cut, $25. 1:02 p.m., American Eagle, Slim Straight Jean, Dark Tinted Indigo, $49.95. 1:25 p.m., Precision Time, Toxic Area 51 Men's Watch, $189. 2:18 p.m., JCPenney, Hanes 4-pack Boxer Shorts, $40, Gold Toe 3-pack Crew Socks, $17, Levi's Reversible Belt, $30, Dockers Trifold Wallet, $28, Dockers Faux Leather Black Bomber Jacket, $140, Brighton Collage Picture Frame, $60. All total, he spent $960.84, which we discovered later he stole from a jar that Mom had hidden in the back of her closet for emergencies. Almost exactly $1,000 once you include the sales tax. He could have almost bought a car for that. Then he rode the bus back and walked the 7 miles so he could arrive home around 3:40 p.m., just in time to pick up the phone when Mom called to check on him, which she always did when he got home from school. He told her he had a good day. Then, as far as I can figure, he spent the next 2 hours putting together the pictures and the collage out in the playhouse. At 6:07 p.m., he ordered a pizza. Canadian bacon with pineapple. His favorite. If it took the normal amount of time to be delivered, the pizza would have arrived by 6:45. He ate 3 pieces, then wrapped the rest and stuck it in the fridge to save for Mom and me. He put his plate in the dishwasher. He spent some time doing regular stuff on the internet. He clicked on 3 fairly random links. He set his new clothes, basketball shoes, socks, underwear, jeans, belt, wallet, Trailblazers t-shirt, bomber jacket, sunglasses, in a neat pile on top of his bed. For him to be buried in, we could only assume. He made 2 phone calls, both to numbers that I don't know and I haven't had the guts to call to find out. He sent 1 text. He wrote 1 note. Then, at 7:49 p.m., just as Mom was getting ready to get off her 12-hour shift, he went into the garage. He loaded the gun. He took the safety off. He called 911. He pulled the trigger. The bullet struck him in the chest, severing his subclavian artery. It took him 30 to 60 seconds to bleed out. And then he died. 33. In this dream, Ty and I are rock climbing, something we never did in real life. Okay, not rock climbing for fun, I surmise, from our apparent lack of ropes and harnesses. Cliff climbing. On an at least 500-foot cliff. Fun times. We don't talk in this dream. We focus on making our way up the rock face. It reminds me of the Cliffs of Insanity from The Princess Bride. The blue, endless sky above us, the blue, crashing ocean below us. Only there's no Andre the Giant to take us up. No rope to climb. We just have to make it on our own. About 20 feet from the top, the ledge I put my weight on crumbles from under me. I start to fall. I open my mouth to scream, like screaming is all you can do when you're about to plummet to your death. But before the sound leaves me, Ty catches my hand. He pulls me to a safer spot. "Thanks, I breathe.
You really messed up, he says.
I know.
No, with Damien. That was a disaster.
Yes, yes it was.
You should apologize.
I plan on it.
You should work it out beforehand, he advises. You're not very good on the spot.
Oh, thank you, Ty. Thank you very much.
No problem.
How are we going to do this? I ask him, craning my neck to look up the cliff.
I don't know. Be more careful, he says.
The words have just left his mouth when he falls. It's not like it was with me a few seconds ago, all slow motion where I have time to scream and he has time to grab me. He reaches up, grabs a rock. He makes a distressed sound like, whoops, then he's gone. I look down just in time to see his body hit the rocks before a wave crashes over him. 34. Monday morning. I have a speech, an apology, a plan. That's the funny thing about plans. The first thing that goes wrong is that I wanted to drive to school today, in order to get to school early, in order to have plenty of time to seek out Damien. But then the lemon doesn't start, and I spend so much time trying to get it to turn over that I miss the bus. I call Sadie, hoping to get a ride, and get this, she informs me primly that she took the bus herself, to save money, for her college books, she tells me. Right. I do finally get the lemon started, but I don't get to school until after the first bell rings, so there's no time to head to room 121B with the crudely crafted paper flower I made for him yesterday, which says, I'm sorry, on every petal. It's lame, it's pathetic, but I'm hoping it will work. Then we have an impromptu danger drill at lunchtime, where we all have to pretend that there's a shooter on campus and get under the tables and lock all the doors, so I don't see Damien then either. But I can track him down during 8th period, I rationalize. During 6th period, as everyone's getting set up for gin rummy, the game of the hour, I ask Miss Mahoney if we can talk. Absolutely, she says. What's up? I wonder if there's some extra credit I can do to make up for my lousy midterm. Of course. Or you can still retake the test if you'd like, Miss Mahoney says without hesitating, which is funny because there is no of course about it. Will Friday work for you? Lunch hour? Friday will work. Excellent. Friday it is. I turn to head back to the card table, but she stops me. Can I ask why you changed your mind? She asks. I mean, your original grade isn't great, but it's not that important in the grand scheme of things. You don't have anything to prove to me, Lex. I know you know your stuff. So you don't have to. I got into MIT, I say. The whole room goes quiet. Miss Mahoney's mouth falls open. As in the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. As in the best mathematics program in the country, she says. That MIT. Yes, that MIT. Lex, that's amazing, she says, when she's recovered enough to speak. And what's great is that I know she means it. Her face has gone pink, she's so pleased for me. That's wonderful! There's a part of the acceptance letter that warns that their offer is contingent on me passing the rest of the school year with flying colors, I say. I see. That makes sense. So I intend to give them flying colors. She looks like she's about to start dancing. I have no doubt that you will, Lex. Wow! MIT! Congratulations! Thank you. I allow myself to smile about it then, for the first time. I let myself feel it. Back at the card table, my friends are all staring at me with a quiet awe.
Very impressive. Eleanor says as I take a seat next to her. You deserve it.
This is big coming from her, because I know she applied to MIT herself, and this must mean she didn't get in, or hasn't heard yet. Thanks, El. Beaker, on the other hand, looks pissed.
You didn't tell me you got into MIT, she accuses, shuffling the cards like she's punishing them.
Uh-oh, I'm in trouble.
I didn't know how to tell everybody, I try to explain. I think I wanted some time for the news to sink in before I went public.
She still looks pissed. Clearly, this excuse isn't good enough for her. She's my best friend. She should have been the first person I called.
What about you? Have you heard back from any place yet? I backpedal.
Williams College, Sarah Lawrence, Amherst, but I'm still waiting for Wellesley.
I'm sure you'll get in, I tell her. Beaker's been fantasizing about Wellesley for a while, something about it being all women and one of the best liberal arts colleges and Beaker wanting to explore career options, since in addition to math and science, Beaker loves theater and plays a killer flute solo, and she doesn't know what she wants to be when she grows up. She nods, but her expression says she doesn't forgive me. We settle into playing rummy. A few minutes into the game, I notice that Stephen is smiling. Like, he can't stop smiling. A secret kind of smile.
What? I ask, finally.
What's going on with you? His smile widens.
Nothing. It's just that I'm happy for you. Truly.
He picks up a seven of hearts from the discard pile and sets down three pairs of sevens. Eleanor snorts.
Right. You're happy for you, too.
Ill, he warns. Don't.
Don't what?
She ignores him and turns to me like this is something that needs to be said, and she has appointed herself the messenger.
He's going to Harvard.
I glance quickly at Stephen, who's blushing.
You got into Harvard? I gasp.
I got into Harvard, he admits.
This is huge. I feel the urge to hug him, to celebrate, but that would be decidedly awkward.
You got into Harvard! Why wouldn't you want her to tell me that?
He scratches at the back of his neck.
It felt like we should be celebrating your moment, that's all.
Eleanor smirks.
Right.
I still don't get what she's being so cat-ate-the-canary about.
What's wrong with you?
She fixes me with a no-nonsense stare, like she doesn't understand why I haven't already figured this out. MIT and Harvard are both in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Did you know that? She asks.
I think I did know that, yes, I say,
and I understand immediately where she's going with it. I visited both campuses last year. They're 2 miles apart. She pulls out her phone, which we are not supposed to do in class, but Miss Mahoney generally allows, because she's not supposed to be watching YouTube either, and does a quick search. Yes, it's 1.96 miles from MIT to Harvard. 9 minutes by car. You and Stephen will be 1.96 miles away from each other for the next 4 years. Now do you see why he's so ridiculously happy?
Oh, come on, Stephen says, and he's really blushing now.
My face is red, too. I turn to Stephen, who's meticulously studying his cards.
So you're going, of course, to Harvard, not to Yale or Dartmouth or any of the others?
He doesn't smile this time, but it's in his eyes.
That's the plan.
I bet your family's thrilled.
They're over the moon. I'm the first Blake male who's not going to be a farmer, and they could not be happier.
And how about you? Is it what you wanted? I know it is. We didn't discuss it much when we were applying. We didn't want to pressure each other. But it was the best-case scenario. Me at MIT, Stephen at Harvard. It meant the possibility of more. But that was before. His warm brown eyes meet mine.
Well, you know, he murmurs. I hear Harvard's a pretty good place to study chemistry.
I instantly have butterflies in my stomach, and I try to squash them. I wet my lips and attempt to breathe properly. How does he keep making me feel this way, even with all that's happened? I should not feel this way. I think about what Ty wrote in his letter, how it's so obvious that Stephen and I are right for each other, that we fit. Beaker and Eleanor have been looking back and forth from me to Stephen gleefully, like they'd like a bowl of popcorn. Then Beaker throws me a lifeline.
Hey, are we playing cards here or what?
She asks, rearranging the cards in her hand.
Time is candy, you know.
We go back to playing, but Stephen is still smiling. I have a hard time concentrating on the game. I'm so befuddled by the exchange with Stephen, the idea of Stephen at Harvard, that I forget to ditch eighth period, so I don't remember about delivering the paper daisy to Damien until the bell rings at the end of the day. I check his locker. He's not there. I try his cell phone, but it goes straight to voicemail. I bump into Elle in the commons, where everybody is milling around. "Lex, are you feeling all right? You look scared," she observes. "I am scared, for a reason I can't quite put my finger on. Damien should be here. Why isn't he here?" A bad feeling is boiling up from the pit of my stomach. "Can you help me find Damien Whittaker?" I ask Elle.
"Sure. Who's Damien Whittaker?"
I fish the photo of the three amigos out of my backpack. "This one." I point to Damien.
"Oh, gray hoodie," she says. "I know him."
We check the library, the gym. We start walking down the halls, poking our head into random classrooms, hoping to find him. Somewhere along the way, we pick up Beaker, then Steven, who checks the guys' bathrooms and locker room. No Damien. Back in the commons, Elle hacks the school's computer system to check the attendance record. "He's marked absent today. No explanation as to why. It's an unexcused absence," she says from behind her laptop, "which means his parents didn't call him in sick." That's when the terrible thought occurs to me. I grab Elle's laptop and turn it toward me. I check a few of Damien's social media websites before I stumble across a new poem on one of them. "She makes the stars go out. She makes the rain. I give her my heart as a rose made of paper, but she lets it fall on the dirty floor. She gives me a cup full of pity and pain to drown myself in." And this is when the terrible thought becomes even more terrible. "What does that even mean?" Elle asks from over my shoulder, reading the screen. The poem was posted an hour ago. I try to ignore the panicked clenching in my stomach and take out my phone to call Damien's cell. I get his voicemail again.
"Hi, you've reached Damien. You know what to do," he says.
I hang up. I don't think he'd want to hear my voice right now, but I have to see if he's home. "Get me his home number," I say to Elle. "The landline." She finesses the school's record system again and produces a number. It rings and rings and rings. No answer. No machine.
"Lex, who is this guy?"
Steven asks. "Gray hoodie," Elle fills in helpfully. I jump up. "I have to go. What's his address?" She clicks some keys. 2585 West Mill Road. I'm already running for the school's front door, for the parking lot, for my car. Elle, Beaker, and Steven fall in behind me. 2585 West Mill Road, I repeat to myself. That's not far, right?
It's about 10 minutes, I think, Steven calculates.
But the lemon doesn't start. I turn to my friends, panting a little. Tell me one of you drove. Elle doesn't have a car, and Beaker looks guilty.
No, she says. I got a ride with Antonio.
I turn to Steven. He shakes his head.
Sarah has the car today.
I try the lemon again, but it's no use. Why, I think. Why will the universe not give me a freaking break?
Lex, Steven starts nervously. What's going on? Do you think that Damien is... Why do you think that Damien's going to...
I shake my head. Be quiet for a second, okay? I need to think. So I think as hard as I've ever thought. I strain every neuron, and I see the answer. I dial and lift the phone to my ear.
Come on, I whisper. Come on, be awake.
Hello, says a sleepy voice. What's up?
Seth, I breathe in relief. This is Lex. I need a favor.
Sure, Lex, he says. Your wish is my command, yo.
Thanks. I meet Steven's eyes. Seth, I'm going to need that ride. 35. 12 minutes later, I'm flying up North 27th Street, headed out of town, my teeth chattering, my hair tucked into Seth's helmet, holding Seth tight around the ribs. It's warmer out now, but still chilly. Over our heads, white cirrostratus clouds are stretched in rows across the sky, cut by the sharp trail of a plane descending into the Lincoln Airport.
Are you all right back there? Seth yells.
Can we go any faster? I yell back. We're going so fast already, but Seth pushes the engine harder, making the telephone poles start whipping by us at an increased rate. I'm so cold I can't feel my face. We turn on West Mill Road and head out into the deep farm country, cornfields and more cornfields. The snow has melted, leaving the muddy brown fields stubbed with the dead corn stalks from last year. The farmers will plow it all under soon and plant again. The air smells like cow manure and fresh water and growing things. It smells like spring. I hope we're not too late. Seth asks for the number again, and I yell, 2585, and he slows way down and yells,
I think this is it up here.
We pull off onto a long driveway and drive up to a gray two-story house. I recognize Damien's car parked out front. Yes, this is it. Seth takes us right up to the front step. I clutch at him as he leans to put his foot down.
You'll have to get off first, he says. Just swing your leg around.
I dismount in the most awkward way possible and take off the helmet. I hand it back to Seth. We both step back to get a look at the house.
Whoa, Seth says. Gothic. I bet this place is haunted.
Ramshackle is the word I would use. It's your basic two-story farmhouse with the windows that look like eyes and the door like a mouth. It needs a new paint job and maybe a new roof, and it does look like something out of an old black-and-white horror movie, but it has good bones, as Beaker would say. I climb the porch steps and knock on the door. Nobody answers. I knock again, harder. I find a doorbell, but when I press it, I don't hear any sound.
I don't think he's home, Seth says.
No, he's home. That's his car, I point. I bang on the door with the flat of my hand. Damien! Open up! It's Lex! No answer. He's mad at me. Maybe I shouldn't scream, it's Lex, quite so loudly. I try his cell again. I try the home number. We listen to it ringing inside the house. I feel more desperate with each ring. Damien! I scream. Come on! Seth looks worried.
Alexei, what's this about? Why are you so freaked?
Damien was Ty's friend, Ty's and Patrick's. I bang again. Damien!
Yeah, so?
So he's depressed right now, and I did something on Saturday that upset him, and he didn't show up to school today, and he posted this poem on the internet, and... I call the house number again. Come on, pick up, Damien. It rings and rings. Seth looks at the house with new awareness.
So you think he might off himself?
He glances at me, cringes.
Sorry, you think he would...
I think he would. I have to get in there. Seth pounds on the door.
Damien! Come on out, dude!
I go around the side of the house, checking the windows. They're all locked. I try the back door, locked. I try the other side of the house. On that side, I suddenly become aware of music floating down from a second-story window. Acoustic guitar. Then a lone male voice. Robert Plant's voice, from Stairway to Heaven.
Damien!
I holler up at the window. No answer, no movement, nothing. Seth comes up beside me. He squints at the house.
Hey, there's a light on,
he says. I'd bet money that's Damien's room. I glance around wildly. There's no way to get up there, no convenient, helpful tree or gutter to climb. I cry out in frustration and head back to the front door, Seth trailing me.
Are you going to call the cops?
He asks warily, like he gets why I would need to do that, but he's not too fond of the police. No, it would take too long. I need to get in there now, I say, my mind going a mile a minute. I turn to face him. Pick the lock.
What?
He's in there. He could be dead already. He could be dying. Right now. Do it, Seth. Seth glances toward the bedroom window.
You think he's killing himself right now?
I think there's a strong possibility. If we're lucky, he didn't do it 15 minutes ago. I know he was alive an hour ago, but now I don't know. He rubs a hand over the back of his head.
Man.
Pick the lock, Seth.
Hey, I don't know how to pick a lock. What, did you think that just because I smoke and ride a motorcycle and I have some tattoos, it must mean I'm a criminal? Hey, what are you doing now?
I don't look up from my phone. Googling how to pick a lock. I dump my backpack out onto the grass and sort through what comes out until I find two large paper clips. I get to work shaping them into lockpicks. Sometimes it pays to be a nerd and carry around a large assortment of office supplies as a general habit.
Whoa, Seth says. I don't know if I like this. It's illegal, right, breaking and entering?
I'm on the porch by this point, crouching in front of the door.
You're making me like an accessory, Seth says.
I push the straightened pin into the lock. You're free to go. He doesn't go, though. He watches me as I try and fail and try and fail again.
Okay, so you can't pick the lock. So what are you going to do now?
Here. I hand my phone to him. Read it out loud to me. The part with the raking. It says the squiggly paperclip is the rake and the straight one is the tension wrench, but then what does it say? He stares at me.
Lexi.
Help or go, Seth. Help or go. He sighs and clears his throat lightly.
First, slip your tension wrench into the bottom of the keyhole and use gentle pressure in the direction you want to turn the lock. Then, take your rake and quickly slide it back and forth to jostle the pins into place.
Go on. I swipe at my forehead with my sleeve. What next?
After raking back and forth through the lock, quickly jerk the rake out of the keyhole while attempting to turn the tension wrench. If everything is gone just right...
There's a loud click. I turn the knob. The door swings open.
I can't believe that worked,
Seth murmurs. I'm already taking the stairs two at a time. I'm sprinting down the upstairs hall. Damien! I follow the music to the last door on the left. The song is in the hard rock part of it by this time, loud and wailing. I try the door. It's locked. I left the paperclips downstairs. I imagine Damien behind his door, his body sprawled on the carpet, his wrists cut and bleeding, his eyes open but unseeing.
Whoa, Lex, wait!
Seth's coming up behind me as I raise my foot and kick at the door hard. It crashes open on the first try, the cheap particle board doors splintering, and I push into the room, Damien's name on my lips. He's there. He's sitting at his desk in his boxers, staring at me, his mouth fallen open. The music is so loud around us I can't hear anything else. I stand there, chest heaving, staring. Slowly, he reaches up and turns off the speakers. I feel like I've gone deaf. Damien, I manage to get out. You're alive. Seth pipes up from behind me.
I'll be outside, okay?
Damien closes his eyes and opens them again slowly, like he must be hallucinating the sight of me. I'm so happy to see him alive that I can't help but smile. So, I say after a minute, this is awkward. He scratches at the side of his neck.
Can you turn around or close your eyes or something so I can put my pants on?
Sure. I clap a hand over my eyes.
Not that I haven't fantasized about a situation like this,
he says. I hear the whisper of denim, the zip of a fly.
Okay.
I lower my hand. He sits down on the end of his bed and puts on a t-shirt and socks. He motions for me to sit in the desk chair where he was sitting a minute ago. I sit.
Okay, he says. Let's start with, what are you doing here, Lex?
You weren't at school today.
I was sick,
he explains. You don't look sick. His face is turning red.
I was embarrassed. I didn't want to see you, okay?
I nod. I was worried about you.
Why?
I read your poem. His eyes brighten.
You read my poem?
He tries to keep his voice steady, casual.
What did you think?
I thought you were feeling so bad that you... Finally, he understands.
You thought I'd be like Ty and Patrick.
I let out a breath. Yes. His watery eyes meet mine. He brushes his hair out of his eyes and leans forward, settling his weight onto his knees.
I'm not like Ty and Patrick.
He says very slowly, like he wants to be sure I understand every word.
I don't want to die. Things can get bleak sometimes at school. There are bullies, right?
The carrion few, I supply. He glances away, laughs weakly.
Right. But I don't have it in me to... It's just high school, man.
Those guys are just high school guys, and in 10 years, they're going to be working for people like me. I know that. I have to make it through 2 more years, and then I'll be home free. I swear, I couldn't ever do what Ty did. I would never.
He takes a deep breath and lets it out.
I'm sorry if my poems made you think I would.
I'm sorry that I inspired one of those poems, I reply. I feel something sharp in my pocket, poking into my hip. I remember what it is and pull it out. Ty's shark necklace. I hold it out to Damien. Here, I found this. He takes it and fingers the edge of the tooth gently. Suddenly, there are tears in his eyes.
I should have told you, he says. I've been working up to it, but I didn't know how.
Told me what? He swallows.
Ty called me the night he died.
It feels like my heart stopped beating, but I know it hasn't. If my heart stopped beating, I would die. But here I sit, alive, breathing, listening. Damien's voice wavers as he keeps talking.
I knew that Ty sometimes thought about what he did. 2 years ago, the first time he tried with the pills, he told me afterward.
He told you? I never knew that Ty told anyone.
We were playing this song by the Doors, The End, and he told me. I said, you know, we can talk about how things suck and how our parents are assholes and how the future isn't exactly super bright, but I still think life's worth living, don't you? And he said, yeah, he knew that. And I said that if he ever felt that way again, like ending it, that he should call me. And he said he would.
And he called you, I whisper. You talked to him. Damien nods.
But he didn't say anything that night about wanting to die. It wasn't that unusual for him to call me, actually. Not so unusual that I thought anything was up. We've kept in touch, even though we don't hang out much at school. He called me sometimes, and we'd talk about how life blows, and people are morons, and how most people don't understand what it's like when your life just goes to crap and there's nothing you can do about it. He read my poems sometimes, too. So that's what we talked about that night. The same old stuff.
He shakes his head.
I should have known something was wrong. He'd just broken up with Ashley, and he was low. He seemed like he was stuck in his own head, and I should have figured out that something was off.
He snuffles.
I've thought about it so many times since then, been over the entire conversation back and forth, looking for clues that I should have picked up, but sometimes I think he just called me to say goodbye.
He clutches the shark tooth in his hand and starts full out crying. I move to sit on the bed next to him and try to hug him, and he lets me for a little while. Then he pulls away and drags his hand through his hair and sighs.
I'm sorry I didn't save him, he says. I would have tried.
My heart aches for him, because those words are my words, and those thoughts are my thoughts, and I finally understand why they don't matter. You couldn't have saved him, I answer. Nobody could have saved Ty but Ty. And you're probably right. He wasn't calling so that he would be talked out of it. He was calling to say goodbye. Damien nods miserably. I squeeze his shoulder. You were a good friend to him, and to me. Thank you for that. We sit for a minute not speaking. Then I ask him, Are you okay? Do you need to write a poem to get it all cleaned out? He laughs.
I'll back off the black-hearted poetry.
I shrug one shoulder. I'm not a book critic or anything, but I like your poems, Damien. Although I wouldn't give you a cup full of pity and pain to drown yourself in. I'm all out of pity. I stand up and go to the window. Outside, the sun is setting over the cornfields, a marvelous haze of fire orange and royal purple. I watch a V of large birds, sandhill cranes, I think, riding the air, migrating home. There is so much inside me in that moment I feel like I'll burst. So much I understand now that I didn't yesterday. So much to say.
Lex?
Damien asks from behind me.
What are you going to do now?
I turn. Actually, do you mind if I borrow a pen? 31st of March. I need to tell you about that night. I know you already know the details. You were there. But I need you to see it from my perspective, so you will understand why I did what I did. That night, we had dinner at the Imperial Palace. You had lemon chicken, like you always do, and I ordered Kung Pao chicken. Over dinner, we were talking about MIT and Harvard and Beaker maybe going to Wellesley, and how we had at least 70 days left before we heard anything, and how hard it was to wait. March felt like eons away that night. After dinner, you took me to the Natural History Museum at UNL. It was closed for the night, but because your sister works there, she let us in. I knew you were planning something spectacular by the look on Sarah's face, the way she kept smiling at me. You left me in the Elephant Hall, staring at the giant fossilized bones of prehistoric mammoths and camels and rhinos that used to roam the grassy plains that once stretched across the middle of the country hundreds of thousands of years ago, while you and Sarah disappeared for a while to set things up. Then you came and got me. You blindfolded me, but I could tell you were leading me to the planetarium. How many shows had we seen there, Stephen, really? You sat me down on a soft blanket. I could smell candle wax and your aftershave. There was music playing. Mozart, I think. You'll have to tell me sometime what exactly it was. A soft serenade of piano and violin. You took off the blindfold. We were sitting on a red plaid blanket, like we were having a picnic in the woods, with two short white candles burning in the center, and a bottle of sparkling cider in a bucket of ice, and two plastic champagne glasses. On the planetarium ceiling, thousands of tiny blue lights shone down on us. Not stars or constellations, but particles.
"It's from the show on dark matter," you said.
I craned my neck to gaze up. I thought dark matter was invisible. You leaned back and put your arm around me, pulling me to your chest, and I relaxed into the heat of your body.
"It is invisible," you said. "Well, theoretically it is. Scientists have never been able to prove that dark matter exists, you know."
I did know.
"We can only truly conceive of the fact that it's there because of the way the galaxies behave as they move through the universe, and how the light will always bend around it."
You shifted your body closer to mine. You looked down at my lips. I knew you were going to kiss me. Your breath, which smelled like lemons, bathed my face. You looked into my eyes.
"Anyway,"
you murmured,
"it's pretty."
You kissed me. I curled my hand around the back of your head, your hair soft under my fingers, and kissed you back. Blue lights spun over our heads. You kissed the corner of my mouth, my cheek, my ear. I smiled. "So, this is romantic."
"Yes, I wanted to be romantic."
You laced your fingers with mine.
"It's December 20th,
you announced. "Yes?" You tucked a strand of my hair behind my ear.
"On June 20th, 6 months ago today, we started this little experiment. In a bookstore, which was not the most romantic place, but the best I could do at the moment. I didn't think I'd be able to get you in here back then. And on June 20th, I kissed you for the very first time."
"It was a good kiss?"
"Spectacular," you remembered.
"So happy 6 months," I said.
"Happy 6 months, which is precisely 183 days.
You consulted your watch.
"Which is 4,392 hours, which is 263,520 minutes, which have been some of the best minutes of my life. So far."
God, you were sexy. Irresistible. I pulled your head down to kiss you again, but my phone suddenly buzzed. I took it out and looked at it. It was a text. I never told you who it was from. I never said, "It's my brother." I never told you what it said. All this time, and I've never told anyone. But I'll tell you now. It said, "Hey, sis, can you talk?" This is the part where reality unravels for me, the part where I turned the phone off and slid it away from me and we went back to kissing. But there's an alternate version of what happened that night. There always will be for me. In the alternate version of reality, I get the text and I tell you, "Hold that thought," and I kiss you quick, once on the mouth. But then I get up and take the phone to the hallway and I call Ty. In that reality, which I know isn't a reality but a fantasy, wishful thinking, a prayer that goes unanswered, Ty tells me what I need to know. That he is sad, that he's stuck in the present, he can't get perspective, he's lost the future. Then I tell him that he's strong enough to get through the sadness. I tell him I don't want to go through this messed up world without him, and I tell him that I need him. I tell him Mom needs him. I tell him even Dad needs him. He may not see that right now, but he will see it sometime. I tell him that in 5 more days it will be Christmas, and I remind him that Christmas is his favorite holiday, and we'll wake up early and bounce up and down on Mom's bed like we did when we were little, and we'll belt out silver bells as we scurry downstairs to the Christmas tree and unwrap our presents. And I got him something good this year, and doesn't he want to find out what it is? I tell him that we have a minimum of 63 Christmases left to share with each other, and I don't want to miss even one of those, not one. I tell him I love him. And me telling him those things is enough to slay his demons. And he lives through the night. He lives. But instead, I turned my phone off and I kissed you. We stretched out under the dark matter, that invisible, improvable stuff that binds the universe, and I looked up at you, all framed in blue lights, and I said that I loved you. Your eyes flashed with surprise. You didn't expect me to say it. You thought I didn't believe in love. But you didn't hesitate to answer.
"I love you too," you said. "So much."
"It's impractical how much," I whispered. You nodded.
"Totally impractical."
We drank the cider and talked about dark matter and talked about how we are all made of the stuff of stars, that wonderful quote from Carl Sagan. We are each part of the universe. Then somehow the conversation shifted to the subject of sandhill cranes. How every year, in March, if the weather holds, 80% of the world's population of sandhill cranes pass through this one part of Nebraska. Millions of birds all at once, and how it's supposed to be this incredible sight to behold, and how we'd both lived in Nebraska for our entire lives, and we'd never seen the cranes. We would go, we decided. Before we went off to Massachusetts, or wherever fate was going to take us, we would go see the sandhill cranes. Together. We kissed then, and time bent around us. Time went away. But somewhere in those missing seconds, my brother was walking into the dark cocoon of the garage with Dad's old hunting rifle and a bullet I must have overlooked. To ruin everything, I think, sometimes. To die. We only came back to ourselves when Sarah burst into the planetarium, and I knew the second I saw the look on her face that something was terribly, terribly wrong, and that something involved me. I remember she said, "She's right here," before she handed me her phone. I remember it was my dad's voice I heard then, sharp, like I was in trouble for something, like he was grounding me.
"It's Ty," the sharp voice said.
I don't remember what else. I was looking at you. He was telling me. My hand started to shake, not tremble, not waver, but shake, violently, like I was having a seizure. I couldn't control it. You reached up and put your hand on mine. You held me steady. After I hung up, you guided me down the hall toward the parking lot. You put my coat around my shoulders. You knelt beside me when I suddenly veered off and bent and vomited my Kung Pao chicken onto the snowy sidewalk next to the giant mammoth statue in front of the museum. You helped me stand up. You smoothed the hair away from my face. You reached over me to buckle my seatbelt once you got me in the car. There were Christmas lights all along the way to the mortuary, red and green and white, strung through the trees. The whole time, your eyes were wide and incredulous, like this couldn't really be happening. At the mortuary, you waited in the hall while the funeral director took me and Mom and Dad into her office and played us a recording. Ty had called 911 seconds before he